105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, June 22nd. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an archived interview with Vermont mystery writer Archer Mayer. Before turning his hand to fiction, Archer Mayer wrote history books. Prior to that, he was variously employed as a scholarly editor, a researcher for Time Life Books, a political advance man, a theater photographer, a newspaper writer and editor, a lab technician, and a medical illustrator. In addition to writing novels and occasional articles, Mayer gives talks and workshops all around the country, including the Breadloaf Young Writers Conference in Middlebury, Vermont, and the Colby College Seminar on Forensic Sciences in Waterville, Maine. He is also a death investigator for Vermont's chief medical examiner, a deputy for the Windham County Sheriff's Department, and has 25 years' experience as a volunteer firefighter and EMT. His critically acclaimed series of police novels features Lieutenant Joe Gunther of the Brattleboro, Vermont Police Department. The New York Times has called Archer Mayer the boss man on procedures. When I interviewed Archer in June 2008, we began by discussing his early aspirations.
So I'm curious what you wanted to be when you were a kid. Did you want to be a fireman or a writer?
Neither.
Neither, and you ended up both.
No, I wanted to be a storyteller, I think, but I didn't know what kind of storyteller. So at first, I began as a liar. I would tell tall tales, adventures. And they were proximate enough to reality that they might have passed muster. They caused enough concern on my parents' part that my father came up with a protocol. And the protocol was that he would stop me very early on in the telling one of these tales of what had happened at school that day or whatnot. And he would say, is this a real story or a make-believe story? And he proclaimed later that he was astonished at my brief honesty, because I'd tell him the truth. I would say whether it was or wasn't a real story. And then he'd say, okay, continue, and I would launch forward. So I began life as a liar, and then I became an illustrator. I would put together cartoons, comic books. Now,
how old were you at that point?
I was a little guy. I was under 10. I'm not terribly good at my own chronology, but I remember various heights. You know, where I encountered the rest of my family vis-a-vis my eyeballs.
Right.
You know, their belt buckles or their chests or their heads or higher, you know, because now I'm the tallest guy in the family. My first three-dimensional or two-dimensional writing projects were miniaturized comic books, which featured World War II soldiers. That was phase two. Mm-hmm. Phase three, I guess extrapolating from the illustrations of those comic books, I became a photographer. Now, my father, whom I adored, by the way, he died at the age of 99 just a few years ago.
Oh.
My mom is still alive, and she's pushing 90. I adore her, too. I'm surrounded by people I like immensely. It's such a drag for a writer because you're supposed to suffer and hate people and whatnot. So I'm disadvantaged. So anyhow, I took up from my father's habits the life of a photographer. I think a lot of that had to do with bonding. When you move around a lot, you look for similarity in touchstones, and our touchstone was the darkroom. So that was photography. I did that for quite a few years. I actually worked as a professional photographer. And that is, as I see it, storytelling of a form. I enjoyed it. I was okay at it, but I never got to that level where I recognized that I could really stand out. So eventually I walked away from photography, went to journalism, and began to try writing. This was a bit of a wobbler because, of course, you can't really make a living at that. And newspaper writing is curiously unsatisfying artistically. Mm. It's functional, and it teaches you good things about deadlines and brevity and the hook. We were laughing earlier before the interview began about grabbing an audience in the first paragraph. It taught me all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But to be perfectly honest, it is not a place to stay, I think, over long if you have artistic aspirations. I went into editing, book publishing, a variety of other things. I probably had about 20 different jobs during my life's journey. And I ended up in, let's say, the mid-1970s, working as an editor for the University of Texas Press as a special projects guy. And for reasons I won't bore you with, I was sort of restrained to quarters. In a nutshell, I had been too successful. I'd made them too much money, and that was becoming an embarrassment. So they wanted to keep me in the office. No more bestsellers, in other words, because that throws off the whole red ink, black ink equation with the mothership, which
really?
Was the University of Texas. Yeah, yeah. This is the a bit of the quirkiness of working within academe. So I was restricted to quarters and began to type because I was bored out of my mind. And that's where I finally discovered my storytelling niche.
Mm-hmm.
It had been a somewhat sort of silly and arduous route to what was fairly plain, which was just sit down and write, stupid, as Dashiell Hammett might have put it. But I was a late bloomer and a happy bloomer. Once I discovered writing novels, I was truly in my element. In 1980, I quit, and I've never worked really for anybody full-time ever again.
Huh.
Moved to Vermont in 1980. Continued writing these novels. I have about 9 unreadable novels.
Right, I remember
novels,
hearing.
Just awful damn things. But they're learning curves.
Well, now that's actually my next question, which is that I had once heard you speak, and you had said that you had multiple novels that were never published. And I'm just curious how you persevered through that period of time, or did you not try to publish those?
Oh, good Lord, of course you always try to publish them because all your babies are perfect.
Right.
You know, even though everybody in the room is sort of going, how do we politely tell this fellow that his baby is a monster? If you're honest with yourself, the stimulus is that your work can always be improved. It's mm-hmm. not that it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's that it's flawed. Mm-hmm. All the books in my head are perfect. All the books on the page are imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stimulus, not a disappointment. So when someone says to me, it was all right, but I have issue with this, that, and the other. And if those issues ring an inner bell in my head, I'm going to be encouraged by that and say, oh, well, thank you for your honesty, and that's great. And the bell is ringing in my head, and I will go back and rewrite.
Mm-hmm.
I am a passionate rewriter. I think editing is an absolutely crucial 50 percentile part of the job. And you're a fool if you think otherwise. If you really do roll in a sheet of paper into the typewriter and type it out and go, ah, perfect, and put it aside, I think you're self-delusional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everything we do in life benefits by failure and by honing. That's just the way I look at it.
Now, 9 novels unpublished, though.
Yes.
So that must have been hard after a while, no?
No, it was a legitimate learning curve. Remember, I was brought up in Europe, and in Europe you have an old-fashioned way of looking at things. You begin as an apprentice, and what does the apprentice do? The apprentice, you know, serves coffee and takes out the laundry and deals with feeding the cat or whatever it is that is done in the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
Only little by little do you get introduced to the tools that are actually used in that occupation. And then eventually you're allowed a little project that the master, you know, might well throw away and disparage inordinately.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes years to work up through journeyman until you get your own shop. That, I think, is a worthwhile voyage.
Mm-hmm.
It has value. I think your stumblings and your rejections and your coming face to face with your own imperfections is a constructive thing
mm-hmm.
and a worthwhile thing. And we in this country are so bloody impatient and so intolerant of accepting failure. I hate to be too harsh, but I also find in Vermont oftentimes we're too bloody nice to each other. We all say, oh, what a nice work that was, or whatnot, when in fact it wasn't. It was well intentioned. That's fine. You can politely and supportively tell people that their stuff is bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to be dishonest. And I think we're oftentimes dishonest for the sake of politesse. And mm-hmm. I think that does nobody any service whatsoever. Certainly, the person whose work you privately thought was terrible, but it doesn't benefit by your dishonesty, and certainly you don't. You know, you go to bed that night and you think to yourself, "Wow, not to put too fine a point on it, but I lied." And is that a gift that a fellow artist makes to someone else? No, it's not.
Right. It's probably even harder when you know the person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Which is why when I have recommendations to writers, I say, for example, never, ever, ever give your manuscript to the people you sleep with or the people who gave you birth. You know, that's not fair. Give it to people whose opinion you respect, but whom you can't blackmail.
Right. Very good. I want to talk about Joe Gunther a little bit. Can you describe him for anyone who hasn't read one of your novels?
Well, Joe Gunther, funnily enough, he's a bit of a Boy Scout. He's avuncular and kind and thoughtful and generous and caring and giving. And he's a total bore on that level. He is probably the best guy you could ever hope to meet. Certainly, if you aspire to be someone other than yourself, you could do worse than aspire to be Joe Gunther. Joe Gunther is not perfect. And that, of course, is what helps make him almost perfect, is that he even has clay feet. He even screws up. So I have created this fellow quite on purpose, and that is that he is a sounding board. He is someone off of whom most of the other characters in the book react.
Mm-hmm.
So we have males and females alike in these books, all of whom have their own personalities. But those personalities more approximate our own. I mean, let's face it, none of us are Joe Gunther. We might aspire on a good day to be as thoughtful, caring, giving, and blah, blah, that Joe Gunther is, but we're rarely going to achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
For other people who have read my works, we most often end up like Willie, who is this cranky, nasty, opinionated, blunt-spoken fellow, who is also in the series of books. Joe Gunther was created so that I, if you were to use a shipbuilding metaphor, so that I had a keel that would hold this series of books together.
Mm-hmm.
I have indulged myself, I won't deny, by writing this series, by conceiving it not as a bunch of separate books, but as a single book, almost like a soap opera, if you will. And each episode is book length. So every year I write another episode of this ongoing opus, and it's about Joe and his guys. Well, as a result, I needed this figure who would be consistent and stalwart throughout the entire series of books, and that's Joe. Initially, he was a first-person narrator, and about 12, 13, 14 books into the series, I have the 20th is in my head, I changed that. And I changed it because I realized that finally these other characters had grown roots sturdy enough that they wanted to stand on their own. And if you are writing a first-person narrative, how do you put them onto center stage, to mix metaphors, and the only way I could do that was abandoning the first person narration, and I did so. I can't remember. Oh yes, I do. It was a book called The Sniper's Wife.
Mm-hmm.
Is when I stepped out of the first person, and I've been delighted with that.
How did your readers react to that?
Seamlessly. Funnily enough, very few of them responded or reacted.
That's
I don't think they even noticed many of them. Isn't that funny? Yeah, they just, which I guess is great, because I think the storyteller's task, almost above everything else, is to disappear, is to yield the storytelling to the reader as much as possible. I mean, after all, when we read something that we enjoy very much, we do so in the absence of the writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the book is so full and so complete in our heads that we don't even think of the writer.
Mm-hmm.
doesn't exist. And so I think maybe I did my job well enough that they didn't even know the difference.
How about the editor? Did you have the same editor from the first half to the second half of the series?
I've had a variety of editors, some of them appallingly bad. I guess I did have the same editor during that transition, and he was quite pleased. I think he was very happy. He wasn't complaining earlier.
It didn't seem like a dangerous move.
No. I hesitated, actually. I'd been thinking about it for several books, and it wasn't until I wrote The Sniper's Wife, which I also called the Willie book. This is the cranky figure I alluded to earlier. He's a native-born New Yorker.
When he goes to New York?
Yeah, he goes to New York. His ex-wife dies, and he wants to find out why. And he was very nasty to her in the old days. And so he's riddled by guilt, and he goes down to sort it out. Mm-hmm. And it brings him to the foreground, and it takes place in New York City almost entirely, which was also a first for me.
And Joe is not as present in that. He is toward the end, right?
Yes, he comes down because he wants to find out what's going on with both his employee and his friend. And he's a nurturing fella. He's a father figure type, and he takes care of his people along those lines. Mm-hmm. So he goes down to New York, actually with another pal of his, a young woman who ends up being Willie's girlfriend a few books later.
Sammy. So that's almost a risk on two different levels because
sure.
you switched from first yes. person to third person, and then you yes. also removed Joe for a while.
I liked stirring that up, yeah. And that's the advantage of writing this endless opus, and that is that I will break up relationships, I'll create new relationships. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I've knocked someone off. Although I will never do that with the big players. Of course, you never say never. At this point, I don't have any intentions. There was a couple. Joe had a woman named Gail that he was inordinately fond of, and she lasted. They lasted for book after book after book, and they finally broke up.
And she's still a presence in the series.
Right, she's still a presence in the series, very much so, because she's a very politically minded, and everyone suspects, myself also, that she may well run for governor. Although I don't know that for a fact, but if she does, obviously that's going to be a book. But they broke up. So everyone went, oh my God, you're going to kill her. And I just thought, what a cliche. I mean, just because someone breaks up doesn't mean you kill them. I mean, you might feel like killing them, but it usually doesn't pan out that way. And it's not going to pan out that way
it's
in my books
television.
Either. No, it's not television. Exactly right.
And I noticed in chat that you actually, you have political arguments that come up in the book,
yes.
from different departments mm-hmm. within the government and the police. And so that's the kind of...
One of my other jobs, I mentioned I had about five of them, and one of them is I'm a police officer. I work for the Windham County Sheriff's Department mm-hmm. nowadays. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, my political views or my social views may be distinctly opposite from some of the guys I work with. As was the case when I worked for 25 years in EMS and in the fire business, fire prevention business. but that's the company I like to keep. I don't hang out with writers much because they do what I do. I want to hang out with people who don't do what I do mm-hmm. and who don't agree with what I say mm-hmm. and who don't hold my views. Or share my culture or whatever. That's interesting and informative and stimulating to me. So I'm afraid I'm not a guy, like I ride a motorcycle, but everyone goes, so you want to go on this big motorcycle ride together. No, I don't. that's a group. I don't want to be part of a group.
Right.
So I just instinctively go away from that. Discussing politics, even within bureaucracies, has always been a part of the books because it is very much who and what we are. We are political animals, whether we admit that or not, when we work in our workplaces. And I'm not talking Democrat, Republican. I'm literally just talking palace politics around the water cooler.
Right.
We take political stances.
Right. And it seems like within that world, they're talking a lot about crime and punishment and the appropriate balance of crime and punishment.
Yes. Yes. Well, here's one of the interesting revelations that I made when I became a cop, and that is that officer discretion, which is a sort of known legal phrase, officer discretion takes place all the time out there in the streets. You get stopped by a cop for whatever reason, and there's a dialogue that ensues. The cop is finding out who and what you are and what you've done and why you did it. And there's a debate going on in that cop's head. I mean, yes, she or he is controlled and, well, not controlled, but advised by a whole bunch of statutes and training and experience. But in the final say-so, I mean, if you really want to get down to it, that cop could walk away or could give you a warning or could drag you off to jail, depending on the elements of the quote-unquote crime. Mm-hmm. A lot of that falls to officer discretion. This is fascinating to me. This introduces a whole world of judgment, which if that ain't food for the cannon, nothing is.
Before we go any further, could you read a little bit?
Oh, sure. No, I'd be delighted.
So this is Archer Mayer reading from his novel Chat, which came out last year from Grand Central Publishing.
Yes. This is the beginning of Chapter 2. It was postcard serene. Trees coated in white snow hanging low over a tumbling brook whose boulders were colored with sugar halos of ice sparkling in the sun. The painfully blue sky overhead daubed the darkly rushing water with the hint of a bruise as it emerged cascading from a large cavern-like culvert projecting from under a quaint backcountry dirt road. Joe Gunther studied that road a moment. It emerged from the woods like a fairy tale prop, entered the sunshine, its snowy shoulders dazzling in the light, leapt the culvert, and vanished as magically into the darkness of the trees on the far side. There were no railings hemming it in as it spanned the water, not even a curb. In fact, if viewed from a low enough angle, the road appeared to cross the brook as if by the stroke of a paintbrush. What do you think? Joe glanced over at Sammy Martins, his only female squad member, and as close as he had to a lieutenant. I think it's dangerous as hell, he said. Bet more than one driver's gotten white knuckles crossing this thing. Not to mention the odd pedestrian, she added ruefully. Joe nodded and grunted his agreement, approaching the edge overlooking the water. Sam joined him to stare down at the swirl and tumble of the stream gushing out below. There was a pile of boulders right at the mouth of the culvert, then a widening where one of the banks tabled out slightly to form a small beach where the trees downstream crowded in once more and narrowed the channel to create a miniature whitewater chute that raced off around a bend. At the edge of the snow-clad beach, the water slowed and flattened enough to create a pool, no doubt a popular swimming hole during the summer. Not that Joe had been hard-pressed to conjure up such an image, since floating face down in the middle of the pool was the body of a fully clothed man.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
So, there's the suspension.
That
wasn't,
thickens,
yeah,
yes.
And that wasn't even the opening chapter, which was also very suspenseful, in which something happens to his family members. All right, so you're a death investigator for Vermont's chief medical examiner.
Yep, that's another one of the jobs. Yep.
And you're a deputy for the Windham County Sheriff's Department.
Correct.
And a longtime volunteer firefighter and EMT. So I'm sure these are invaluable in writing your books.
Yep.
So can you just talk a little bit about how that goes together?
And how everything feeds
on
itself.
How does everything feed on itself?
Yeah, quite constructively and successfully for a variety of reasons. Some of them a little less obvious than others. Now, of course, obviously, if I write about dead people, then it's nice to hang out with dead people. So, obviously, that speaks for itself. So the death investigator part of me is immediately and obviously enhanced. However, a lot of this didn't come about so obviously. I moved to Newfane, Vermont in 1982, and I began to inject myself into the social fabric. What better way, as we all know in Vermont, than by joining the fire department? Well, this was good. I was a medical illustrator during the Vietnam War in a VA hospital in Cleveland, Ohio. I was familiar with death and dying in bits and pieces and all this medical stuff. And along those lines, I'm sort of cold-hearted anyhow, if you will, and quite comfortable in the midst of chaos. So all that seemed a perfect fit. But none of it had to do with enhancing my writing. I instead wanted to be useful to the world around me instead of merely living off of it. I wanted to engage with my fellow citizens. I wanted to know them. I wanted to find a family. I wanted to end up where most people start out, which is in the embrace of a community. We begin our lives in a family, in a hometown, in an elementary school or a high school, from which, ironically, we yearn to be free. We want to leave home. We want to get the hell out of town. We want to do all that good stuff. Well, I was brought up in a Ford, or maybe it was a Buick, or for all I know, it was a Fiat. I yearned for all that stuff. In college, I remember all these guys sitting around the dining room table, and they're singing, you know, pop songs I didn't know the lyrics to, and reminiscing about experiences I wished I'd been able to share. And they were all common territory to them, mm-hmm. but strange to me. So here was my opportunity at the ripe old age of 32 to reinvent, or invent, in fact, a childhood. So I did. And I became of use, which is a wonderful sensation. And maybe that's where Joe Gunther came from, because Joe Gunther is most emphatically of use. Mm-hmm. And I began to bridge between an isolated man traveling the world and a sense of community. And that bridge became stronger and stronger and stronger as years went by. And my expansion into that community by becoming variously all those things you just listed made for a richer, deeper connectedness. And I think that has indeed enhanced all the books.
Knowing as much as you do about procedure and detail based upon all these jobs that you've held, mm-hmm. do you ever find that you are including too much for the reader, that you find you have to go back and winnow out some of the bureaucracy
yes.
of police work?
Yes. That's oftentimes where I will use outside readers. Outside readers, I find, are crucial to the process. I actually either hire or have friends who are steely-eyed enough and certainly have been well-trained either by themselves or by me telling them to be hard-hearted and to absolutely say, you know, this just doesn't work for me and I thought this coincidence was absurd. Or, as in your case, it just gets boring at this section. I know it's interesting to you and I know it's interesting to any other cop who's reading the book because that's the world they inhabit. But your readership is like 1% cops and 99% other people, so get over it.
Right.
You know,
right.
You're going to have to speed up the process a little bit and cut out a lot of this hardware.
But that said, you've been praised in reviews for, you know, writing a very believable and honest police procedural, you know, really sticking to the way things are actually
right.
managed.
That was the ambition from the get-go. I have to admit that when I began this series of books, I did aspire to telling police stories pretty much as they are in fact. So you show people, you know, drinking bad coffee and working through paperwork and just it just functioning in an office like any other office, and the palace politics and the water cooler arguments. But, oh, by the way, they also deal with, you know, killers and drunks and dope dealers and hookers and whatnot. I mean, how bizarre is that? All the rest of us are just working offices doing whatever we do.
You've talked about how you do a lot of research and you go out and talk to people, do interviews so that you can educate yourself. Who do you talk to? I mean, how do you know who to turn to for what you need? You know, for example, how would somebody who's not a mm-hmm. cop. Mm-hmm. No, like, who do I go to find out how it works? Yeah.
Well, and indeed, I wasn't always a cop. So you go to the police station and you say, okay, I'm a writer and I don't know anything about what you do, but I want to do an honest job, and I would love to interview someone. And who can you recommend? And they'll oftentimes have someone you can talk to. Mm-hmm. People love to talk about what they do. And cops are no different. And police chiefs, certainly if you went to the police chief, he or she would be sensitive to their public relations. I mean, everyone's funded by somebody. They'll take a good look at you. And if obviously if you're behaving weirdly and, you know, coming with helicopter blades attached to your hat, you might get what you deserve. But if you are professional and respectful and open, they'll talk to you. Uh-huh. And by they, I mean anybody will talk to you.
Where did you conduct the chat lingo research? Did you just go online and look at how people talk online?
I have children. They're adults. And, of course, so I can approach them. One's 30 and one's 25. And I got a hold of them and said, guys, I am in need. And, of course, they're all over this.
Right.
You know, they know this stuff in and out. In fact, one of them runs a whole team of computer experts. I mean, he works for Verizon as a computer guy, which is about as accurate as I can get, since I have no clue what he does for a living. But these are the people who you consult. And I was just able to keep in the family. So my daughter was able to plug me in and email me attachments that I just flat out put right in the book, you know, almost sight unseen.
I read one time the author of Silence of the Lambs, Thomas Harris.
Yes.
I don't remember the exact wording, but he said you have to keep, as a writer of potentially disturbing material, you have to keep your mind open to your darker side, to the things that will sort of occur to you that other people might shut out as soon as it starts to occur to them. You have to keep open to that so that you can use it in your book. Do you find yourself occasionally when you're working on a crime scene, mm-hmm. or, you know, the chat texts that you were writing, and turning away from it, finding it sort of just hard to write?
No. I have rarely been surprised at human depravity. I find human beings capable of almost anything. And that's been proven to me time and time and time and time again. It's not, you know, I'm not a cynic. I'm a romantic. I cry at movies. I believe in true love, you know, and all that good stuff. But I'm also a realist, and I'd be a complete self-delusional fool if I wandered through life like Pollyanna. Mm-hmm. And Pollyanna was truly make-believe. When I find my own brain visiting those of others who are far darker than I don't need to veer away. I don't find it foreign country. Mm-hmm. It's not country I inhabit, but it's not country that I'm appalled by. I think it's a good idea to know your enemy, and if you want to lead a righteous life with kindness and consideration for your fellow human being, you better bloody well know what the flip side is. Mm-hmm. So walk a mile on the dark side and get to know it and understand it and its motivations and what triggers it. And I think that will only be enhancing.
And then have Joe fix it.
And then have Joe fix it. Exactly. There is no bliss in ignorance, and Joe is there to help.
Okay. Well, when you work on a series, how do you keep it fresh and maintain its authenticity?
That's a challenge, I won't deny, because you know that old saw that there are only 7 plots or whatever the number is, and what we've been doing since the birth of time is just to retell the same stories again and again and again. Thus, it becomes the telling of the tale rather than the tale itself that has relevance and art and beauty to it. You try to write fresh every single time you write a book, and thus your 20th book should be approached as your first book was, with that fright, that fear of stumbling, that sudden, or I should say that thought that I still have, that I'm going to turn out a book, and this is the one, this is the book, that everyone's going to go, oh my God, he is a fraud. He doesn't know how to do this at all. All is revealed. He's out of the closet at last. You know? And that's a wonderful, scary place to keep yourself. And I think that's how, personally, I avoid the threat of dullness and brain numbing is through fear of failure. I write scared. And that's actually why I write without a plot. If you need to go back to that earlier question, I write without a plot so that I keep that nervousness at a peak.
Mm-hmm. One of the aspects of your work that's regularly mentioned in reviews is the human side, which isn't necessarily typical in crime fiction.
Right.
The Washington Post Book World mentions your sharp social observations, and they love you in Washington. The Washington Sunday Times wrote that you have an ability not only to understand human relationships, but to convey them to readers. Anyway, I read those reviews before I was reading Chat, and then I got to this. Do you mind if I read something from
here? No, carry on.
I got to this passage, and I thought about this. Joe's observing a character named Dan Griffiths. Dan Griffiths had always been a bully, a drunk, and a self-involved show-off from the first time Joe met him many years ago. Unfortunately, despite the soothing adage that such people were forgettable, they were not, and their abusiveness mattered and cut deep. It was, in fact, their very careless aggression that caught the public eye and put them higher on the food chain of notoriety. They became a force not only because of the violence of their demeanor, but because of the paradoxical respect society granted them as a result. People may admire a good man, but they will more often rally around a brute. And I thought that was an interesting commentary about Dan and just about people in general. And then I thought, you know, that is sort of an unusual aspect in crime fiction to talk about human nature in that way. So my question, I'm actually getting to a question, mm-hmm. Do such observations about humanity, do they come to you as you're writing, they just come out naturally, or do you work some of that in order to help characterize Joe as the person he is?
No, they come naturally. As you may have surmised by now, I am an opinion son of a bitch. I mean, I've got a thought about everything, and I love to listen to the news. I love to listen to argument and debate about current events, and on subjects great and small. I don't care if it's a little tiny community dispute or the thing that's ruling the nation. I had as much George Bush in mind when I wrote that passage, funnily enough, as I did Dan Griffiths, because it applies to both characters. Here's a little, tiny, small-town bully, and here's the President of the United States who's turned himself into a bully. Interesting to me and relevant to me because both situations apply, very much so. That scene, I remember. I was having a bad George Bush day, I guess. I was listening to the radio, and he'd done something I thought was pretty outrageous. And so I'm writing, and I'm in my zone. I am writing only about Dan Griffiths and Joe Gunther and all the gang. But it all of a sudden occurred to me that what I had to say about Dan had a more universal meaning as well. And I'm not George Bush bashing, but I am leadership bashing, if you will. I don't care who your metaphorical George Bush may be. There are people outside your physical reach who affect you immeasurably. Mm-hmm. But it's funny you chose that one passage because it's not often people will read me a passage and I'll go, wow, I don't remember that one. But I do remember this one.
I noticed that Joe likes the Burlington Police Department, but he doesn't much care for Fletcher Allen Healthcare.
He's been lost there too often. This is a very confusing building. I have to admit, now, in all honesty, yeah, Joe Gunther, on that level, he is me, and I am him. You know, usually I give people say, are you Joe Gunther? Of course I'm not Joe Gunther. But I do have his challenged sense of direction when I'm in that building, you bet. And that's, of course, where the medical examiner's office is. And I cannot tell you how many times I've been lost looking for my own boss's office. I've been going there for years. And every time I go up there, every few years, I go, oh, my God, they've changed something else. And I can't get to where I need to go.
Right.
It drives me crazy.
I want to talk a little bit about your publishing house, AM Press.
Yes.
When did that start and why?
Well, that was actually kind of interesting. One of the byproducts of being a successful writer, and by making ends meet, I know I qualify as a successful writer. I ain't no Stephen King, but I do make my living, however paltry, by writing, and I know that puts me in a very small, special category for which I'm very grateful. However, if you are in that category, you will discover that you are absolutely not loved by the people in the industry, your publishers and editors and all that. You are a pebble on a beach. And if you go out of business, they've got 43 other dozen writers lined up outside their door ready to fill your spot. So they don't need to do a whole lot of care and nurturing. You need to recognize this. You need to understand that, no, nobody loves you. You better love yourself. And you better love your mother so she'll love you back. Because what I discovered was that the more books I wrote, the more I became sort of old news. Oh, yeah, he came out with another book. Now, my readers are very supportive and very excited, and bless them all. My publishers, whatever. You know, what's Arthur Major, Archer Major, whatever. You know, so eventually these books came out of print. Well, I sort of contacted them, more or less, more metaphor than reality now, and said, in effect, guys, we have a product here. And the product just isn't the latest Joe Gunther. The product is the whole Joe Gunther work. And there's a momentum tied in there, and we could actually make money selling this product. It's kind of like running a hardware store where all the shelves are empty. It doesn't make sense to put these books out of print. And they just kind of went, huh? So that was the end of that communication. So then the next step was, well, okay, I tell you what, if you're going to put all my books out of print, and we're now talking 12 titles were out of print, will you give them to me for free? Just because, what the hell? Nothing's, and I'll be damned if they didn't say, yeah, sure, here they are. So they gave them back. Lock, stock, and barrel. I was stunned. Because they're actually, you know, boilerplate contractual things that say that's not supposed to happen, but they were happy to do it, and they did it, and I ended up owning the rights to my first 12 books.
That's great. That's hard to do. Stories about it being nightmare.
But this is one of the beauties of being completely neglected. They don't even know your name. They couldn't care less. You're fine, whatever. Will you stop bugging us? Because that's the other thing. I can be a complete nag. So here I am now with these 12 books, and I finally discovered what my house was truly for. Mortgages, liens. So I took out several mortgages and took out a bunch of loans and went to the bank and acquired more money in debt than I ever had in fact. And I put together a publishing company, AM Press, Mr. Originality here. And AM Press exists solely at this point to publish my books. So now the hardware store is full of product. I have my 12 books, and I think I'm going to add another one because I just got the rights back last week to St. Albans Fire, which I think is number 16. So I have 1 through 12 plus 16, so it's going to make the numbers on the spines a little weird. But anyhow, in as far as running Ampress, it is a task. It's a job and a half. I have a woman I employ to help me with this, and so she'll do, you know, some of the detail stuff that just I'm either not very good at or that she's very good at or whatever. But it's a lot of work. And so on top of the police work and the death investigation and blah, 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 and all the writing I need to do for AAA Magazine or my novels or the lecture circuit or the publicity season every fall, it's a traffic jam. And that part occasionally catches up to me. If ever I have moments of true weariness, it's at what I've chosen to take on and what I've also chosen not to take off. Mm-hmm. In other words, I don't need to be a death investigator. I don't need to be a cop. I don't need to all. Yeah, I could cut all this out. But as far as I know, I only go around once. Mm-hmm. And I love all this stuff. And I love being of use, as I pointed out earlier. I love the emotional and intellectual content that this affords me. And I guess I'm too greedy to give any of it up. I have given up the EMS and the firefighting. I did that for 25 years, and I've now stepped back from that. I miss it. I loved it doing it, but I couldn't do it anymore. So when I looked at my overall spectrum when AmPress came on board, I went, okay, I got to cut something out. And I cut that out because a quarter of a century is a good long time to do anything. So AmPress has been and continues to be an adventure. It's a fine line between being in the black and being in the red.
I was going to say, is it paying off?
It is. It is, because one of the other premises behind AmPress was I thought the New York publishers had missed the market. They called me a regional writer with a strong regional voice and therefore tried to sell me in Des Moines or wherever, Cleveland, you know, take your pick. And I kept saying, there are 10 million people in northern New England, or the four states that comprise northern New England. That's a lot of people. You could make a bestseller just by selling to those people. Why don't we focus on the people I can actually physically reach in my Subaru, driving around, saying, hi, glad to meet you, buy my book. But they never did it. They were always aspiring to where it wasn't going. They literally said, you're not selling well in the Midwest, so we're going to send you out there for a bookstore event. And I went, nobody's going to be there. I'm not, you know. And so they sent me, and no one showed up. I went, well, so now it's a failure. And they went, yeah, that didn't pan out. That was a waste of money. And I went, great, now you see me as wasting your money when I told you don't do that.
Right.
So now I was able to practice what I was preaching. I'm really only selling in northern New England. I was told by Barnes & Nobles, for example, and Borders and all the rest of them, okay, well, we'd love to sell you in Phoenix, but you've got to go through our system here, and we need a 60 to 70% discount in order for you. And I said, no, that's too bloody much, and I'm not going to do business with you. And their comeback was, well, you're not going to sell any books in Phoenix. And I said, tough.
Oh, well.
Yeah, oh, well, exactly. You know, if anything, my hope would be, if I can make a big enough splash in New England, word will go on. If someone goes to Phoenix, to the Barnes & Nobles, and says to them, I want this book, you think they're not going to try to sell it to them? Yeah, they are. So they'll make a special order. They'll contact my distributor, and they'll buy my bloody book because their customer will want it. They're in the customer business. One way or the other, they can find me. Or, God forbid, you go to archermere.com and you hit buy, and you just buy the book that way. Mm-hmm. And the heck with Barnes & Nobles.
I'm glad you mentioned that. You've got a great website. So,
oh, thank you.
Let's just
It's been a lot of fun.
It's archermayor, archermayor.com.
Yep, that's it, good. In a nutshell.
Yeah, lots of family photos and little blurbs here and there about your life.
Yep.
Very good. Do you still work with an agent?
Yes, I have two agents. I have one in New York City who's a literary agent, and I have a Hollywood agent who puts together the boilerplate stuff, language on any Hollywood deals, and I probably had about 10 of those, perhaps. But
have any movies been made?
Oh, God, no. Oh. No. It turns out that actually is the crux of a good many businesses. The publishing business is no different. It's all about not doing a deal.
Uh-huh.
So the movie business is all about not making movies. About 10% of them do make movies, and thus we have the movies we deserve. But so I've got this twosome, and I like them both. They're nice people.
Have you stayed with the same literary agent since the beginning?
Yeah, forever and ever.
How did you get your agent originally?
Well, I stumbled about. I went through several agents to begin with, and you know, a couple died, and then the rest didn't work out for one reason or another. But I bumped into Molly pretty early on. She's younger than I am, and she was just starting out, and she was working for the Aaron Priest agency in those days, and her name is Molly Friedrich, and she's a lovely gal. And we just connected. And funnily enough, she had the good sense to reject several of my books early on. Just said, terrible, terrible. And, good luck with somebody else. But I liked her honesty. I liked her hunger, if you will. You know, she was very aggressive. And now she's a pretty well-known agent down there, and I'm glad to be counted in her stable. I'm a tiny member of her stable because she's got some huge names. But she stuck with me, and I stuck with her.
Did she encourage you in any way when she was rejecting those early efforts? Is that part of why you went back, or did you just sort of keep going back because you just liked her?
I liked her. She was one of the few agents who actually did give you her two cents worth. Mm. No, I didn't like this or I didn't like that. But it really amounted to a couple of paragraphs in the letter.
I have one last question for you.
Sure.
If you get stuck in a piece of writing, do you have any exercises or activities that help you move forward in that piece of writing?
I take a nap. And the reason is thus. Writer's block, call it that for lack of anything else, call it anxiety, whatever it is. It's a logjam. It's an emotional logjam. You're writing along, and all of a sudden you get jammed up. Why? Primarily because you have too many conflicting ideas. You've fallen prey to the mythology that there's a right way and a wrong way to do this. There is no right way and wrong way to write anything. There's merely a way that works for you and eventually your readers. And you find that with whatever flashlight you choose to employ. But writer's block is because there's just too much extra information. It's almost like a fighter pilot getting too many control options in his headphones and he just blanks out. Okay? So take a nap. And when you wake up 10 minutes later, I'm not talking about, 8 hours here, open up your eyes, look at the screen, and I will almost promise you that a lot of the logjam will have dissipated, because if it has no meaning, if it has no worth, it dissipates in and of itself. Good stuff hangs in your head. Bad stuff goes away. At least it does for me. My father used to call me in the middle of the day sometimes, and he'd say, he'd always start out until I trained him not to, I hope I'm not interrupting. And I would always kid him and say, I had the Nobel Prize, especially for mystery writers, right within my grasp until you called. Now, what do you want? So he'd laugh and get it off, and that was the end of that. But my point was actually a subtext, and the point is, I don't mind being interrupted. I've got emails, I've got pagers, I've got cell phones, I've got all the same trash everyone else has that interrupts me all through the day. It never gets in the way of my writing, because if it's a good idea, it'll stay in my head through all those interruptions. And if it's not, I can make it up again. I can go in a different direction. I can come up with a new idea. So that's how I resolve being in a jam. I take a tiny break of one nature or another, and I don't let it get to me. In a way, you could say there is no writer's block. There's writer's anxiety, and mm-hmm. that's what you need to address.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Archer Mayer. That interview took place a year ago, and since that time, Archer has published a new Joe Gunther novel entitled The Catch. Next week, please tune in again for an interview with Marilyn Taylor McDowell, author of the recent novel for young readers, Carolina Harmony. I should mention that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. This program is supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world, internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. And by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. Write the Book is also brought to you in part by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington, and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with mystery writer Archer Mayer. Consider your current writing project. Is it possible that mystery might exist within the pages of your story, poem, or novel? Even if it's not a piece that you would define as mystery, perhaps a small puzzle woven throughout would pique reader interest. Maybe you're writing a family story. Could there be a cousin or aunt who disappeared long ago, or rumor of a treasure buried in the great-grandfather's backyard? This needn't be the focus of your piece, but a captivating subplot that could add something exciting to the work. To Kill a Mockingbird is not a mystery, of course, but Boo Radley is a figure who inspires great interest. So keep in mind the interest that a riddle can provoke, the pull of a secret. A copy of this prompt will be available in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, which unfortunately we didn't have time for today, but it is a general regular feature, and so if you have an event that you'd like listed, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned now for Cheryl Willoughby in the World of Music. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.